not whether we serve coffee before or afterwards. It's not whether we have to wear a jacket and tie or we can come in torn jeans. It's not whether we have chairs or pews or whether we sing hymns or songs. Those things are not the most important. And what we're exploring in these weeks are the things that really matter, that shape our church, that we need to understand so that we get the right perspective on things, so that we treasure what matters, and so that we can also celebrate the fact that other Christians from different churches have things that really matter to them, that are precious, that enable them in their walk with Jesus, and are their way of celebrating the fact, the central truth, that Jesus Christ is Lord, which is what we focused on last week and really underpins everything that we're saying in these weeks. What I just outlined through that picture is, of course, the experience of Christians in many countries today. Restrictions on how they worship, how they meet. And our forebears in this church faced many restrictions. This is a picture or drawing of a 17th century outdoor meeting. It's not John Eccles, but perhaps he looked a bit like that, I don't know. The clothier from Bewdley who came and preached and planted this church by at least 1666. We know there was a church here. The kind of freedom that we have was a dream. Just a dream. The Test and Corporation Acts, which followed the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, prevented anyone from holding public office or being an officer in the army if they were not a regular communicant in an Anglican church. So if you didn't go for communion regularly to the Anglican church, the Church of England, you could not be on the town council. You could not hold municipal office. So Baptists and others were excluded from holding those kinds of offices. Neither could you be awarded a degree from Oxford or Cambridge because, again, you had to be a regular communicant in the Church of England. And that legislation wasn't rescinded until 1828. The Conventicle Act forbade meetings for worship of more than five people who were not members of the same household. So when those early Baptists in Bromsgrove met in homes, they did so undercover. And there were other restrictive laws. Now, with that in mind, let me read to you from Romans chapter 13, the Apostle Paul writing to one of the early churches. Romans chapter 13, and verses 1 to 7. Everyone must obey the state authorities, because no authority exists without God's permission, and the existing authorities have been put there by God. Whoever opposes the existing authority opposes what God has ordered, and anyone who does so will bring judgment on himself. For rulers are not to be feared by those who do good, but by those who do evil. Would you like to be unafraid of those in authority? Then do what is good, and they will praise you, because they are God's servants, working for your own good. But if you do evil, then be afraid of them, because their power to punish is real. They are God's servants, and carry out God's punishment on those who do evil. For this reason, you must obey the authorities, not just because of God's punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. That is also why you pay taxes, because the authorities are working for God when they fulfill their duties. Pay then what you owe them, pay them your personal and property taxes, and show respect and honour for them all. Paul was writing to an early church about showing respect for their rulers. It's an exhortation to upright behaviour in society. The disciples of Jesus, he's saying, should be good citizens. And you could also look at Romans chapter 12, verses 17 to 18, where he exhorts the people to live at peace with everyone. Or Titus chapter 3, verses 1 to 2, where a similar message comes through. All in response to the love of God made known in Jesus Christ. You can look too at 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13 and following. There are lots of references in the New Testament to saying, be good citizens, submit to those in authority. Yet at the same time, running through the New Testament is a message so radical and so subversive that governments ever since have either tried to repress it or control it. And that message is nothing less than the gospel itself. The good news that Jesus Christ is Lord. That was the gospel Paul proclaimed. And when Jesus went into the temple in Jerusalem after Palm Sunday and chucked out the money changers and those that were preventing Gentiles from coming to prayer and those that were ripping off the poor, Jesus himself, who respected authority also brought a direct challenge to it because he himself is Lord of all. I'm going to read to you some words that, again, might be quite familiar to some of you. And they'll be familiar because we hear them as words of worship to Jesus, about Jesus. Words that express something of our faith in who Jesus Christ is and the sort of thing we sing in our hymns and our songs. But actually, these words are hot political propaganda. Christ is the visible likeness of the invisible God. He is the firstborn son, superior to all created things. For through him God created everything in heaven and on earth, the seen and the unseen things, including spiritual powers, lords, rulers and authorities. God created the whole universe through him and for him. Christ existed before all things, and in union with him, all things have their proper place. He is the head of his body, the church. He is the source of the body's life. He is the firstborn son who was raised from death in order that he alone might have the first place in all things. For it was by God's own decision that the son has in himself the full nature of God. Through the son, then, God decided to bring the whole universe back to himself. God made peace through his son's blood on the cross, and so brought back to himself all things, both on earth and in heaven. When Paul, the same one who wrote those words about submitting to the authorities, wrote those words, the ruling power was Rome, specifically Augustus Caesar, the Roman Empire, which is often pictured as the body politic, a metaphor which saw parts of the empire as a human body with Caesar as the head. And Paul picks up that image, which would have been familiar to his hearers, and he says Jesus is the head of the body. A subversive challenge to the emperor. Back in those days, everyone was required to pledge allegiance to the emperor. And the words they would have used? Caesar is Lord. And the first Christians said, no, Jesus is Lord. To say that was to declare allegiance to a different empire or kingdom, which is why they were persecuted. They were not persecuted because of their religious beliefs. The first Christians were not persecuted because they said, love your neighbor and believe that Jesus died on the cross to save you from your sins so that you can go to heaven when you die. They would not have been persecuted for that. They were persecuted and thrown to the lions because they were seen as a threat to the socio-political order, traitors and enemies of the state, because they would not swear allegiance to Caesar. The message they proclaimed was Jesus is Lord, and it was political. Caesar's not. Jesus is. Good news for those oppressed by a brutal regime, but a threat to authority. Jesus, he says, is the image of the invisible God. Think of dictatorships around the world, whether we're thinking of North Korea and Kim Jong-un, or previously Saddam Hussein. You remember the statue being toppled after the invasion of Iraq? And throughout history, statues and paintings and photographs everywhere to remind the people who's in charge. A photograph and a picture or a statue of whoever is the emperor or the supreme ruler. And it was the same in the days of the early church. Statues of Caesar would have been everywhere, as well as having his image on the coins that they used. And Paul is using similar language to that applied to Caesar and applies it to Jesus. He is the image of the invisible God, the sign of God's presence and God's authority here on earth. How does a king or an emperor ascend to the throne? Well, usually by being the firstborn. And Paul proclaims that Jesus Christ is the firstborn of all creation and of the new creation that God has brought into being by raising him from the dead. He's not primarily talking here about Jesus being God incarnate, God made flesh. Paul believed that. But his expression here, using that word firstborn, is intended to convey the authority that Jesus has. In fact, over all created things, which must include the Roman Empire. Jesus has authority over you, Caesar, is what he's saying by using that word. Caesar claimed to be divine, to be the supreme ruler, the one who is out front, who is before all things. But Paul effectively denies that by asserting that Jesus is before all things and has first place in everything, and that the fullness of the living, true God dwells in him. The emperor claimed to have established peace in all the countries ruled by Rome. It was known as the Pax Romana. We've since had the Pax Britannia, the British Empire. People have also talked about Pax Americana. I don't know what we've got at the moment, but there we go. But peace was enforced by military conquest and the brutal repression of anyone who got in the way. Crucifixion was a common sight in the days of the Roman Empire. Sometimes hundreds of people crucified at the same time when there'd been a revolt. Violence and fear were the weapons used. But Paul talks about the true reconciliation of all things through the sacrifice of the king himself and the shedding of his blood, not of other people's. Through Christ, humanity can be reconciled to God and divisions between people taken away. The stability in Iraq under Saddam Hussein that some people are now looking back on fondly, and other similar regimes around the world that have ruled disparate people groups and nations, is not the way of Christ, but true reconciliation, making friends out of former enemies, is the way of Christ. And Jesus was crucified by the political powers and the religious powers of the day because he challenged the religious attitudes of those who wielded power over what people believed and how they prayed and what they did. And he challenged the political rulers by talking about a kingdom, though not of this world, that was still a threat. And so the first Christians are encouraged to be respectful of those in authority, but there are limits. Earlier in Romans chapter 12, Paul says, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." As disciples, they were to seek first the kingdom of God, to use Jesus' own words, to be salt and light, making a difference in the world because they were different, and challenging the dark places of human life. That's what it means to be salt and light in the world. And this call to live in the world, but not be of the world, to show due respect for authority, but ultimately offer allegiance to Jesus Christ alone, was something new. In the ancient world, religion and culture were inseparable, and they reinforced one another. Religion gave legitimacy to the king and to the ruling classes, who were at pains to remind people as often as possible that that was the case and that the gods or God were on their side, so you better do as you're told. To question the rulers was to blaspheme. And the same has been true throughout history when religion and politics are joined together. More about that in a minute. In the Roman Empire, all religions were accepted. All religions were accepted in the Roman Empire, in the Pax Romana. As long as you paid lip service to the official religion, which proclaimed that Caesar is God and Lord. Sacrifices to the emperor's statue were obligatory. The only exception was the Jews, mainly because they were so flipping awkward. Putting it bluntly, Romans just didn't know what to do with the Jews, and they wouldn't conform, so best to try and accommodate them and keep them within limits. There were occasional clashes and many executions. But the Christians were a new threat. They refused to declare Caesar as Lord, but they didn't belong to one neat ethnic group that could be marginalized. They would pray for the emperor, but they wouldn't pray to him. They declared Jesus as Lord, and they were also evangelistic. They believed in helping other people to discover the truth about who Jesus is and inviting them to become his disciples as well. And they sought to bring others into the church, and they started to grow. And they were a threat. They were seen as revolutionary. Just to lighten the theme a little bit, I told you a story back in June about a man called John Kenneth Galbraith, the Canadian-American economist who served in four presidential administrations. And in his biography, he talks about the family housekeeper, a lady called Emily Gloria Wilson. And he writes this: "It had been a wearying day, and I asked Emily to hold all telephone calls while I had a nap. Shortly thereafter, the phone rang. Lyndon Johnson was calling from the White House. Get me Ken Galbraith. This is Lyndon Johnson. He's sleeping, Mr. President. He said not to disturb him. Well, wake him up. I want to talk to him. No, Mr. President. I work for him, not you. I love that. Galbraith writes, when I called the president back, he could scarcely control his pleasure. Tell that woman I want her here in the White House. But it just illustrates that tension. Due respect for the president of the United States of America, but when my boss says he wants to sleep, you keep quiet and talk to you later. Christianity continued to grow and gain influence, and persecution came in waves. But then in the 4th century, something quite remarkable happened. It's been much debated by historians ever since. The Roman Emperor Constantine declared full toleration for Christianity. And over the next 70 to 100 years, Christianity moves from being a persecuted, powerless minority to being a persecuting, powerful majority. In 380 AD, the Emperor Theodosius declared Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. And Orthodox belief was enforced. Other religions were outlawed. Instead of being a freely chosen and costly faith, it was now compulsory to be a Christian. There were forced conversions at the point of a sword. Armies marched out with their swords blessed in the name of Christ, who said, love your enemies. There was an intermingling of church and state and mass baptisms. And this came to be known as Christendom, the domination or the dominion, if you prefer, of Christ. Opinions vary on whether this was a good thing or a complete disaster for the church. Most people, I guess, see there were a mix of good and bad things. But what is clear is that Christianity as a religion was seen as something which bound society together and that those in authority saw as necessary in maintaining control. That's why in the 16th century, when we come to the Reformation and Protestantism, that's why there was such massive conflict. It was not just about theology or the papacy, but about the relationship between church and state. Britain and parts of Germany and the Netherlands and other countries like Sweden, which became Protestant, saw the king become head of the church. If you know your English history, you'll know that Henry VIII found that quite convenient so that he could divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. But he became head of the church, as today the Queen is head of the Church of England. And whether Catholic or Protestant, the same principle applied. Everyone had to conform to the beliefs and religious practices of the state church. But from the early 16th century onwards, a few people reading the Bible for themselves started to question this. They came to particular conclusions. They read in the New Testament that faith in Jesus Christ was voluntary. It was something you freely chose. It wasn't something you told you had to believe or do. It was personal. It was something you appropriated for yourself. It wasn't something you inherited because you were born in a particular part of the world. They discovered that to be a Christian was to be a disciple, a follower, a learner after Jesus Christ. And that those who were baptized as believers. Those who had said, Jesus Christ is my Lord. The church was a community of faith, of like-minded people who committed themselves to following Jesus and gathered together for worship and prayer and to study the scriptures and to support one another in their daily lives, often giving financially and from their belongings to enable other people in their lives. They discovered that each disciple of Jesus, each member of the church, was responsible for the life and the mission of the church. It wasn't just up to the priests and those in authority. It was actually everybody's job to take part in what Jesus had initiated and help other people to become his disciples. And all of this was because Jesus Christ is Lord and no one else. So if our allegiance is to Jesus, then this is how we should live. This is how we should be together. This is how church should be. And people who didn't conform came to be known as non-conformists or dissenters. And among them were people who came to be known as Baptists. At the heart of their beliefs was a very strong emphasis on religious liberty for everyone, which included saying that actually if people don't believe what I believe, well, I might think they're wrong, but I still believe they have the freedom to believe what they believe, and it's not up to the state to punish them. And that principle, I think, extends to life as a church together, that we may actually hold different views on a number of things, but actually the important thing is Jesus Christ is Lord, not whether I'm right and you're wrong. Two of the most influential people were Thomas Helwys and John Smith. Helwys was one of the first people ever, to argue in writing for the principle of religious liberty. He said that whether someone was an atheist, didn't believe in God, a Turk, by which we could say Muslim, a Jew or whatever, it wasn't up to the king to dictate their beliefs or punish people for what they believed. And it cost Helwys dear.